Hi, Next Big Idea Book Club. This is a book bite for Time's Second Arrow, Evolution, Order, and a New Law of Nature. I'm Mike Wong, one of the authors of Time's Second Arrow, and before I share a conversation I had with my co-author, Bob Hazen, I just want to give a brief introduction to who we are. Bob and I are both researchers at the Carnegie Institution for Science's Earth and Planets Laboratory in Washington, D.C. Bob is a veteran geoscientist who has done highly influential work in mineralogy and the origins of life. I'm an up-and-coming astrobiologist interested in answering the question, are we alone in the universe? Time's Second Arrow is all about some audacious scientific work of ours proposing a new law of nature that helps us describe, explain, and predict evolution in phenomena as varied as minerals, life, and technology. The conversation that you're about to hear between Bob and myself does get a little bit rambly. We definitely love playing off each other, and I hope you get a sense for how much we enjoy tossing around our thoughts together. But for that reason, I just want to quickly outline for you the five big ideas in our book. First, we say that evolution is everywhere, and that the evolution that describes life, Darwinian evolution, is but a special case of a much more general phenomenon. Second, we contend that there is a natural law of increasing order in a world of decay. Third, we propose that information is a vital parameter in the natural world, as vital as mass, charge, or energy. Fourth, we see applications of our law of increasing functional information in numerous systems, from astrobiology to artificial intelligence to cancer research. And fifth, our natural law makes us seriously consider and grapple with the fundamental question of whether science can or cannot address the concepts of meaning and purpose. Okay, with that, please enjoy this conversation between myself, Mike Wong, and Bob Hazen.
What is our book saying? There's sort of these five big insights that we have proposed in this kind of audacious book. And the first one has to do with an everyday phenomenon. Just make a mental image of five things. A mineral, a rainforest, a city, a favorite piece of music, and AI, artificial intelligence. And think about what do those five things have in common? And okay, I'm going to help you out. I'll tell you. The answer is they're all complex evolving systems. They're all systems that in some way over time become more patterned, become more interesting, become more diverse. They do new things, whether it's the world of music where you started with Gregorian chant and then you went through centuries and centuries development and now we have the richness of musical genres we have today, or whether it's cities that start as a few humble dwellings and grow, expand outward, a rainforest, you can imagine this. But even artificial intelligence, which started out as just some very simple computer programs, and now look how fast artificial intelligence is evolving, changing, increasing its ability to do things that it couldn't do a year or even a month ago.
Right.
So there's something about these systems that's in common. They're all evolving. Now, when you talk about evolution, most people think of Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. But what we're arguing in our book is that Darwin's in a supremely important and true special case of a much more general phenomenon. It's the special case that applies to living things where you have genetic information transferred from one generation to the next with mutations, and then those mutations can lead to variations that can be selected for, and that's how evolution occurs. But they're all evolving systems. Minerals evolve too. They also start very, very simply, and the system becomes more patterned, more diverse, more complex, building on itself, getting ever more complex.
Right. And when we're saying that we are proposing a new law of nature, the reason why we're so audacious in saying this could be a universal law is because we see these conceptual commonalities across these very disparate systems.
Yeah.
From, you know, as you said, a rainforest to artificial intelligence. And naturally, one might be inclined to say, no, that can't be because, you know, the mineralogical world is a natural world, is part of the natural world, and artificial intelligence and music are part of the human world. You know, there's a divide there, but we're really seeing conceptual equivalencies in three aspects of all of these systems.
That's right.
First, these systems are composed of many interacting components, right? You've got notes on music sheets. You have bits and strings of computer code making up AI, different species in the rainforest, different atoms that can arrange themselves in different ways and bonds within minerals.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So we think there's a commonality there. And when you see that commonality, then you start saying, well, what else do these have in common? And as you said, they're all made of smaller bits. Those bits can arrange themselves in vast numbers of different ways. And there seems to be a selection process going on, selecting for what we've called sort of in a colloquial way, function. You're selecting for those systems that do something better than the other configurations, which are then rejected. There has long been in the natural sciences something called the arrow of time. And that arrow of time has been described as this something we sense every day, and that's the increase in disorder. You buy a new pair of shoes, they get scuffed. We see people get sick, they get injured, they get old, they die, they decay. I mean, this is just a drumbeat of our lives. You can't escape it. It's a bummer. That's the second law of thermodynamics, or the increase in entropy. And this idea then that there may be a second arrow of time.
So the first arrow of time comes from this increase of entropy, what in science we know as the second law of thermodynamics. It's confusing. Yeah. The first arrow of time.
First arrow, second
law. Second law.
Yeah.
But it's, again, as Bob said, the inescapable fact that things tend to decay when left unattended, right? And we also see this in our daily lives whenever you scramble an egg for breakfast, right? You can't really unscramble that egg. Entropy
is increased. Yeah, I got a hot cup of tea that's sitting here on a desk, and it's, and in an hour it'll be cold.
Right. And that is one inevitable drumbeat of time. What we're suggesting is, through our natural law, is that there is the second arrow in time that describes the increase of patterning, order, complexity, diversity in the universe that is not captured solely by the second law of thermodynamics, by this increase of entropy.
Yeah, and this is a little bit outrageous because there are a lot of very smart physicists out there who say, no, you only need one arrow of time, that the increase in entropy describes everything, and even evolution. And what they say is what evolution does is it gets you to higher and higher states of complexity or organization, which therefore disperse energy, increase entropy faster and faster. So they say that's a cause. We say, no, it's always a consequence. You're always going to increase entropy. No matter what you do, that's wrapped in. But it's not the cause of evolution. There's something else. And that cause is information, in
right.
a sense. In a sense. Because systems go towards states that are more functional. Now, you're the one, Mike, that figured out there's these three different kinds of function. You should tell people about it because this is like your idea.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
We think that there are these three fundamental sources of selection. The first is just for persistence, static persistence, being exactly as you are for some time without decaying toward entropy. If you don't persist for a little bit, you don't get to play the game and continue to ratchet up in evolution. Now, once you have a bunch of statically persisting entities, they might be able to interact with one another, form relationships and connections amongst themselves that form what we call a dynamic system, one that is always intaking new resources, new bits of matter and energy, and exporting things as well, but whose activities then can persist through time. You can think of a hurricane maintaining itself, a star maintaining itself, a human being, a cell, a living thing, an ecosystem maintaining itself, importing low-entropy fuel, exporting high-entropy waste as it must to pay its debt to the second law of thermodynamics, but at the same time experiencing evolution toward more interesting forms. And this is where the third selection criterion, so we've covered static persistence, dynamic persistence, right. Now also novelty generation.
Yeah.
Because if you're a dynamic system figuring out new ways of being, you can invent new functions. We see this all the time in life. The ability to see, the ability to crawl, the ability to fly. Things that can generate novelty will find new ways of being and new ways of persisting. And we think that there's also a selection pressure to be creative.
Yeah. And so we have this common set of characteristics of every evolving system, but how do you measure it? How do you actually say this? And that's where the law comes in, because we are proposing a way to measure this. So imagine a system, let's take a really simple system. It only has a trillion different possible configurations. And you say you want that system to do something. You want it to hold a cup of tea, for example. And there's a trillion different ways you can arrange the atoms, but only a few of them are actually going to hold a cup of tea. And what we say, you can measure the function of that cup holding a cup of tea through something called functional information. Now, that's an idea that was introduced by Nobel Prize-winning scientist Jack Szostak in 2003. He introduced it specifically to talk about genetic material and how much information it could hold, but not just holding information, but holding information that does something. And so it's a fraction. It's based on a fraction. And the fraction is the number of configurations that actually work, which is very small, versus the total number of possible configurations, most of which don't work. That's very large. So you put the tiny number over a big number, that's a very small fraction. And then technically, sorry, you take the negative log to the base 2 of that. It just turns it into a number of bits.
Yeah.
And so this is information of bits. You know, you're familiar with bits. You pay for, you know, your storage of information in gigabits. Well, these are bits. And it turns out that what we argue is that under selective pressure, if you keep generating new configurations, if you keep trying new things and you select for some function, you're going to ratchet up. You get to some level, hey, this works pretty well. And then you start modifying that. And then, oh, here's something that works a little bit better. And oh, here's something that works a little bit better. And as things work better, the fraction gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And if you remember that negative log to the base 2, that means the number of bits gets larger and larger and larger. So this is called the law of increasing functional information. It's an arrow of time that says this is how nature, the mechanism by which nature increases the complexity, increases the functionality of systems, it increases the way systems evolve. And that's true for minerals, it's true for rainforests, it's true for cities, it's true for music, it's true for AI, it's true for all different kinds of systems. 100 systems that you experience in your life every single day evolve, that is, the functional information of the systems increases as new configurations are generated and you select for things that work ever better. I guarantee you next year there's going to be a new piece of music that builds on what came before, but you're going to say, wow, that's like my favorite piece of music ever because it's something new building on what came before.
Right. There's so many applications of this concept of selection for function and the increase of functional information out there. In our initial paper from 2023, we really only touched upon the conceptual equivalencies between the nucleosynthesis of atoms and isotopes, mineral paragenesis, and the evolution of life, just three broad systems. But now we're seeing this explosion of applications in the literature, thinking about evolution through our lens of selection for function in everything from soil ecology, which is very relevant for environmental concerns, to artificial intelligence, like you said,
right.
AI is evolving
right.
very quickly,
yeah.
even to cancer studies and proposing new treatments for cancer that are inspired by this idea of understanding a tumor's progression through ratcheting up in functionality.
Yeah, this crazy idea that a tumor somehow becomes, as an entity, sort of semi-autonomous. It becomes isolated from your body, and then it starts doing its own thing, and now your body becomes the environment in which that tumor is evolving through a law of increasing functional information and ratcheting up from stage 1 to stage 2 to stage 3 and so forth. I mean, I didn't have the vaguest dream that we'd ever touch on something like that. But since evolution is a universal thing, it means if you have a law of evolution that is even remotely touching on kind of the right concepts, And that may be what we're doing here. We may not have the final answer. We probably don't have the final answer. But, you know, we're sort of touching on something that then has implications that go so far. And it makes you wonder then, in an evolving system, if you're selecting for things that work, here you have to make a subjective kind of decision. What do you mean by work?
Yeah.
What do you mean by function? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by this configuration is better than that configuration? And when you start talking about words like that, better, work, you start thinking about meaning. And I think working on this, what we're calling a missing law of nature, brings us headfirst into the question of, is this a natural law that can address meaning, can address purpose? And many people who have heard our ideas have said that. I mean, we've had people who wrote us emails and say, oh, thank you for proving the existence of God.
Right.
Which is not at all what was on our minds here. But for some people, the idea that the universe does spontaneously through a mechanism which is easily understood by just a time-dependent process, go from simpler to more complex, go from less pattern to more pattern, from lower diversity to higher diversity systems. That seems like an arrow of increasing order that one could ascribe some kind of meaning or purpose to the universe. The universe does this spontaneously.
Right.
Well, that's a huge philosophical, theological question, which I don't think we felt prepared to answer ourselves. That's something everybody has to address coming to this. But it's intriguing if someone says to me, yeah, this is a law of purpose. You know, I have a reaction to that. And it's wonderful that you're seeking this in the cosmos. And it's wonderful that you feel natural laws and somehow can give you that. But let me stretch this idea. Gravity.
Hmm.
Gravity is a law of nature. Isaac Newton's idea that if you have any two masses, there'll be a force between them, and that force between them is what allows stars to form. It was what formed planets. It was what's formed the periodic table of the elements through the processes in stars. It's what seeds the universe with the elements of life. So life couldn't happen without gravity.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be a real stretch for me to say that the purpose of gravity is life.
Right.
Or the purpose of gravity is even stars and planets. Gravity, that's a mechanism. It's a description of a mechanism that is an operation in the cosmos. And in the exact same way, our law of increasing functional information is a description of a mechanism in the cosmos. It's how the universe works. And so if you're going to ascribe purpose to that, it's fine. You can say the creator made the natural laws, and the creator made the natural laws in such a way as to lead to us talking about the natural laws, and that gives meaning and purpose. And if you think that, then you better understand the laws of nature, because that's how the deity, that's how the creator did it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same token, if you don't want anything to do with discussions of theology and whether there's a God and whether there's something that's a force greater than us that's guiding all of this, then, gosh, these laws of nature are all you got.
Right.
They are what's controlling your life, and you better understand science to do it. So believe in God, a creator, not believe in a creator, doesn't matter. You still need to understand the laws of nature, because that's you're going to have to live by those laws.
That's right. They
tell us what's possible.
Right, exactly. I see science's project as essentially to understand change in the universe. How do things change? If I apply a force, how will that object's motion change? Those are the laws of motion. If I change something about a system's energy, you know, those are the laws of thermodynamics. How do we see change in evolving systems, this increase in patterning order that we see all around us in our world, in our universe, that went from a very homogeneous soup of hydrogen and helium to stars, planets, galaxies, planets with life,
yes, right?
So how do we understand that change? That's what our new law is trying to get at.
Absolutely.
I feel like understanding the way that evolution operates grants us this agency to influence that process and determine our future through our imaginings of alternate paths and then the selection of the ones that are the most promising, fruitful, prosperous, etc.
Yes. Yeah, this is how science evolves.
Yeah.
This is you and I sitting down at a table and just having conversations, having lunch, and just talking and talking and talking and talking with our colleagues and our peers, and the wider we expand that group and the more different ideas that come in, the more new configurations of ideas, and then you select and you winnow and you funnel and you refine and you chip away. It's like this process of discovery is one of evolution by thinking about configurations. Yeah, it's actually true. You know, biological evolution is incredibly limited because you can only evolve by mutating what is just there, and the mutations can't be too radical or the organism will die. So it's very slow. It's little increment, step by step. But the human mind can imagine things that never existed before, and then you can develop them. And the fact is that AI and some of the related technologies, things like genetic algorithms, which is the way these days engineers design airplane wings or electronic circuits or microchips, that kind of thing. You can try millions of different configurations per second because you can calculate how they will behave, whether a wing will work or not, whether an electric circuit will work or not, because we have equations for those things. So yeah, it's astonishing. That's what human ingenuity and creativity has led to, that was unlike anything that came before.
Yeah.
We are evolving much, much faster.
Bob, is there anything else that you think we should touch on before we leave today?
I think you should look at your life as an evolving system.
Ah, yes.
And I feel that in, for those of you who can't see us, Mike's right at the beginning of his career. I'm right at the end of mine. And so there's a kind of poignant contrast between the two of us working on this fundamental problem. But I've seen through my life so much change, so much pain in some ways. So I'm keenly aware of time's first arrow, that's the increase in entropy, the inevitable, the drumbeat of decay and deterioration, of increase in disorder. And it's so easy for humans, for us as individuals, to succumb to that. You can say a mean word to a colleague that will sting that person for the rest of their lives. And we've all said that terrible thing, that thing that you can never unsay. It is beyond unsaying. But you can also make choices in your life, because there's a second arrow of time. And that second arrow of time is an arrow of increasing order, where we can consider many, many different opportunities. We can think in our mind, should I go this path or this other path? And you can imagine those futures, and you can choose the path that will increase the function, that will increase your ability. You can just choose to smile for someone. You can help the elderly. You can just make choices in your life that make life better for those around you. That is a choice. And it's a choice that isn't the second law of thermodynamics. It is not the increase in entropy. It's an increase in order. It's an increase in functional information. So you too can be part of this evolving universe. You can be part of the universe in which the functional information has been and will continue to increase through time.